I'm really sorry for people outside here just standing out there. I think maybe there's room for about five more over here. I don't know. Professor Nate told me last night there's Volker Heisig up there too.
Hello.
So this is part of the people who worked in our laboratory, Stephen and Volker, and so I didn't expect them here. Professor Nate told me that, he said, don't expect... Bakalovs also, and Rex, hi, I see. He said that we would just have a small gathering with a few students, nothing important, anything. I said, that's fine, very good, that's all, and I slip out back out of the door. And he said, we'll just sit around and talk informally with the students. And then he told me today, maybe you should have some slides. And then he told me there's lots of young men and young women in the room. I am not sure what the best thing to do. This doesn't feel the right atmosphere to make something hard and formal. So I think that I don't want to say just ask questions. This will be a disaster. But what I'll do is go a little fast over some things and try to leave time to talk with you. Maybe that's the best way. And just tell you my feeling of problems in the field. But I put some slides in. So I have to start with more formality than this calls for. And so let me begin by telling you how we'll cover each of the human retroviruses and what we know about them in summary, and then I'll try to talk about the problems with the vaccine. And I'd like to begin with a slide that has to do with philosophy. Some of the problems of the 1970s, before Professor Nate was born. He doesn't know about the problems. So let me begin with the first slide, because I know Professor Nate may not speak perfect English, but he knows how to read very well. It's okay? Yeah. Okay. And before you look at the slide, I want to say I want to thank Rolf. He's an old friend, as you know, for always inviting me here and for staying at his home again last night with his family. And it's always a special pleasure to be back in Hamburg. I feel it's like a second home now after 20 years. Concentrate on this. These were statements that came out in the 1970s, as late as 1978. First of all, the first statement is in textbooks of virology in the United States, clinical virology textbooks, that all pandemics, global epidemics, have to be from microorganisms that are transmitted casually, spitting, talking, sneezing. You know this is wrong, right? The AIDS virus is not transmitted that way, nor are the leukemia viruses transmitted that way, and both are becoming pandemic. So that's wrong. The second statement was the title of a lecture by a very famous infectious disease man who lectured at where I work in Bethesda, Maryland, National Institutes of Health. And the title for the lecture was Influenza, the Last of the Significant Epidemic Infectious Diseases of Man. That's not true. Right? The third statement was throughout the 1970s, I think some people here in the audience remember, a common feeling, let's say, by a lot of people, that retroviruses are not and really cannot be present in man. In fact, the third statement came mostly from retrovirologists. People who were studying animal retroviruses felt by the 1970s that they could not be in man, and I'll try to explain quickly these three things and why they were wrong. First of all, that the pandemics have to be due to casually transmitted organisms was true until the later part of the 20th century. But in the later part of the 20th century, what happened? We had the invention of the airplane, the increased travel by the world. So we have people not exposed to certain organisms becoming exposed for the first time in some cases. All the travel. Second, there was an increase in close contact, physical contact, sexual contact in the last half of the 20th century by people normally widely separated. Okay. Thirdly, blood. The use of blood, intravenous blood, blood transfusions, blood products, blood going from one place to another place, blood from the United States goes to Japan, and so on and so on. So we had possibilities of introducing microorganisms that are not casually transmitted, but are transmitted only by blood or by close contact at people far apart normally. And it goes both ways. People in one part of the world who are not exposed to people in another part ever in history are going to have an interchange of microorganisms that each is unprepared for in that case. That's a possibility. And in that sense, that explains number two. As a global epidemic, we hadn't seen many new things other than influenza be a serious problem. Antibiotics had knocked off most of the important bacterial problems in the Western world, in the industrialized world, and public health measures in the industrialized world led to the belief that things were okay now. Infectious disease was finished, more or less. So I would say that all of this comes to the third point, and not just retroviruses. There are other viruses that are transmitted by intimate contact, by blood, and by the modern habit, the crazy modern habit of the Western world, intravenous drug addiction, which also spreads virus by blood. All these are new things to the 20th century, you know, for the most part, for the Western world anyway. And they would make it possible that microorganisms difficult to transmit could be transmissible. And on the next slide, you see a good example of such a microorganism. Now, that's a cartoon picture of a retrovirus. Such a virus in animals is usually transmitted by the mother to the offspring, the mother cat or mouse to the newborn, by milk, or in utero, in the uterus, and also by sex, and also by blood in the case, for example, of the leukemia virus of the cow. It's a retrovirus. It is transmitted by... Can we do this after? No, yeah. I would appreciate it, not because I don't like you, but I think if we do this, then they are interrupted. They're looking at you and not me, and I like the attention. Okay. All right. No, that's okay. All right. With the leukemia virus of the cow, the veterinarians use a needle, and they inject one cow, and they take it out, inject another cow, same needle. So they were spreading a retrovirus by the veterinarians. So also a 20th century spread of a virus. So this special category of virus is not the only category of virus to be transmitted like this, but it's the one that we are talking about today, the retroviruses. In general, they are transmitted by blood and by sex, and by congenital infection from mother to child, mother to baby, animal, whatever. So this is a typical retrovirus structure. In fact, it is the structure of the first human retrovirus, what we call HTLV-1. The leukemia retrovirus. Now, this virus was discovered in our lab in 1978. It was published in 1980. And it causes a form of human leukemia that is still unusual in the Western world. But it also causes neurological disease. It also can cause some immune deficiency, I'll tell you in a moment. The structure of any retrovirus is like this, but there are variations. The AIDS virus differs somewhat from this. But in general, you have the following features. This is the envelope of the virus. It has an outer part, and it has a part that goes through this material here, which is in blue, lipid material that is picked up by the virus when it comes off of the cell. So this material comes from the cell. This is a viral-coated protein, the glycoprotein envelope. And again, it's in two parts. This is usually heavily glycosylated. So it's called GP, glycoprotein. And its name is named after the size of the protein, GP120, in the case of the AIDS virus. This is the core of the virus. It has an outer shell, which is named according to its size, in the case of the AIDS virus, P17, because it's 17,000. This is the major core protein. This protein and this protein make up the major proteins that we use in the blood tests for the leukemia virus and the AIDS virus. Inside this structure is the viral nucleic acid, shown as two single-stranded RNA molecules. The definition of a retrovirus is that it's a virus which carries a special enzyme, reverse transcriptase, which converts the viral RNA into DNA when the virus infects the cell. Therefore, we have the name retrovirus because of the genetic information going from RNA to DNA. That's the name reverse transcriptase. Reverse transcriptase is a DNA polymerase. It's an enzyme which makes DNA, catalyzes making DNA, but a special one that makes DNA from RNA. If you were asked to define a retrovirus, you would say, well, this is a virus in terms of size, certain structure, which forms by budding from the cell membrane, that has genetic information in the form of RNA, like polio, like influenza, like many other viruses, but is particular and special in that it also carries reverse transcriptase, so that it replicates by having its RNA converted into DNA when the virus infects the cell. And lastly, the most important part of all of retrovirus feature is that the DNA integrates into the host cell DNA, and so the infected cell is infected for the life of the cell. And the person who gets infected is infected lifelong. There's no possibility of it going away, at least on theoretical grounds. Once enough cells are infected, the viral genes become integrated. And when the cell divides, the viral genes are transmitted to the daughter cells. And so the infection persists for lifetime. Okay? Now you could say, well, maybe the immune system should get rid of it. And why doesn't it? Because the infection by human retroviruses, at least of the T lymphocyte, the T4 helper lymphocyte, is an infection which is silent. This is something to remember with all the human retroviruses, that the infected cell usually does not express the viral genes, so that you don't find viral proteins in the cell, except at a very short interval of time. And therefore, the immune system doesn't find the virus-infected cell. The virus only comes out when the T cell is immunologically stimulated. Then it seems that the viral genes become active and the virus forms quickly and spreads. But that's a very short period of time. Okay, so that's a common property of the human retroviruses. Many animal retroviruses will replicate all the time. Now we come to the reason that this problem in terms of AIDS or the leukemia virus will be worse than something like syphilis. Many people say, well, this is going to be like syphilis before antibiotics. But in syphilis, before antibiotics, although the disease was fatal and severe, the infectious period for a young person or an older person sexually exposed, giving the microorganism was very short period, relatively short period. So the infectious period is defined sharply for syphilis. But for AIDS, for the leukemia virus, the infected period is lifelong. As long as the person is alive, as long as the person is sexually active, as long as the person may be spreading blood to someone else, that person can be infectious forever, for the life of the person. So therefore, the situation will be worse than syphilis ever was as time goes by. Now, that doesn't mean that AIDS or the leukemia viruses will explode through a population. That will not happen. But every generation forever, unless this virus mutates out of existence, will be exposed to a fatal infectious disease by sex or by blood, unless the blood is tested. And the biggest problem we have of all is the problem of Central Africa, where the virus continues to spread in a serious way, and it's difficult to do something about. And the problem in the Western world of the drug addicts who don't get educated. They don't listen. The virus continues to spread. Those are the two great problems for the AIDS virus. They're also the two great problems even for the leukemia viruses, which we don't discuss as much because they're not as much of an emergency. Now, how were the retroviruses found? Why did people think that retroviruses would not exist in man? I don't want to bore young people with old things or history, and I don't want to tell people who are here that are senior colleagues who know the story very well So I'll just make it very, very brief. The reason was because in the 1950s and 1960s and early 1970s, people had looked very hard for retroviruses in humans because in animals they were causing leukemia, lymphoma, and sometimes other diseases, neurologic disease. And when they looked, there was nothing by the electron microscope. So there was a conclusion that they must not exist in man. Worse, in the middle of the 1970s, there was the general conclusion that retroviruses in animals, when they cause disease after replicating a lot. So there's lots and lots of virus. You don't need to be very smart or very careful or very hardworking to find retroviruses in mice or in cats or in chickens. And they were the three model systems that the important retrovirologists were studying. They selected those animals because there was lots of virus. It was easy. But they concluded, therefore, that any system would have lots of virus if the virus existed. And this was made into a fact, quote, when in the middle of the 1970s, in the Rockefeller University in New York, a Dr. Hayward discovered that the chicken leukemia virus could only cause leukemia when the genes of the leukemia virus were inserted into one particular place. Let's say this is the chromosome of the chicken, and only would you get leukemia if the DNA of the chicken virus was put here, not anywhere else, and not on any other chromosome. Now, since retroviruses' genetic information integrates randomly, it'll go anywhere. In order to get here by chance, you have to have lots and lots of virus. You understand? So how can you get here specifically if the integration is random? You must have lots of virus. Therefore, it was obvious human retroviruses were not causing human disease. Okay? But we were lucky. We took a different viewpoint. We decided to read the biological virology literature this way, broadly. And we began to read the findings of veterinarians. You know, veterinarians usually are not publishing in the fancy journals. And a lot of people don't invite them to meetings. And on the other hand, if we read about the cow leukemia virus, which was discovered in 1970, we learned that the virus was extremely hard to find. Very little. And that made us think we better look harder in human cells. And so we took two approaches. The first approach was to use this enzyme, reverse transcriptase, as a sensitive assay for retroviruses in man or an animal. And the technology to find the viruses was enormously enhanced by using the enzyme assay as a footprint for the virus. Now we could, by 1975, we had technology to find retroviruses 1,000 times better than electron microscopy, if the assay is done properly, which we spent, along with my colleague who died some years ago, the late Sol Spiegelman in New York, several years to try to develop that technology, to have the enzyme assay sensitive and specific. That's basic science background. It's a lot of years of work, which the amount of pay we got was nothing, less than nothing. Got lots of kicks, in fact. Okay, that was one necessary thing. The second necessary thing we thought was we're going to need to grow the blood cells, because if the target of the virus is a blood cell, and if the virus is present in very small amount, we will not be able to transmit the virus to a cell line, a permanently growing cell in the lab. We need to grow the primary human blood cell. And also, we wondered, maybe the viral genes were present in silent form, and to find virus, you would have to get the cells to grow. So we began to look for growth factors. In 1976, in fact, at the meetings in Vilseda in the Lüneburger Heide, we reported the discovery of a new growth factor, T-cell growth factor. This is today called interleukin-2. Without that growth factor, we wouldn't have human retroviruses today. None. That's the basic technology to find all the human retroviruses, a sensitive assay, combined with growing the target blood cells with a growth factor. Now we know how to do it better and better, especially with the AIDS virus. The AIDS virus you can find, in fact, easier. It is more virus production, and it also infects macrophage, not just T4 cells. And you get a much higher production. So today, now that we understand completely when to look, things are much, much easier in all these systems. Now, to go through this in detail is impossible for this talk, but the epidemiology, the history, the nature of the diseases are summarized in recent publications, which I will give to you on the next two slides as my public relations advertisement. The next two slides. Okay, December 1986 in Scientific American, for those of you who are truly interested. And now when we come to the AIDS virus, the following month, January 1987. Okay, those two issues will describe in depth what we're talking about now with pictures, and I think it's written in simple form. The next slide, please. Now, the next slide shows you a picture of all the human retroviruses as of last week. But in the next few months, there's going to be another one up here. Okay, so there are five now. On the top, you see the leukemia viruses. This is the one we found in late 78 and reported in 1980. This is the one that we discovered in 1981 and published in 1982. We'll come back to these in a moment. These two viruses at the top are about 50% related to each other. The viruses at the bottom, this is the real AIDS virus, HIV-1. We used to call it the third human retrovirus. In fact, because the different isolates of the AIDS virus vary from one strain to another strain, this particular strain names of the viruses will continue. So the virus strains in my laboratory are called HTLV-3, still today, with patients' initials. And the Pasteur group isolates are still called LAV-1-2 when you're talking about the strain. But we agree, generically, the name of the virus is immunodeficiency virus. Now, the virus shown in the bottom right has been called HIV-2. This virus was discovered in 1985 by Essex and his colleagues in Boston. When they did an epidemiologic study of West Africa, they found people were antibody positive, reacting with a new monkey virus better than with the real AIDS virus. The new monkey virus turns out to be a very close relative of this human virus. So Essex first found a cluster of this virus in 1985 in West Africa, but he did not find that it was causing disease. After his report, he described an isolation of the virus and he called it HTLV-4. Unfortunately, that isolate is almost certainly a contamination with the monkey virus he previously discovered. So the monkey virus is real. His discovery of the existence of the West African retroviruses epidemiologically is real, and he should be credited for that. But his isolate, called HTLV-4, is probably, again, the monkey virus by a laboratory contamination. Okay. After that, in 1986, the group at the Pasteur went to West Africa, confirmed the presence of such a virus, and named it LAV-2, and today we agree it should be called HIV-2. They have reported that this virus is associated with immune deficiency, and my feeling is too much about this virus is in the newspapers and not enough in the scientific literature. Every time I have come to Europe, we hear about the spreading of this or headline that it's a new AIDS virus. The truth is, of thousands of sera evaluated now all over the world and especially in West Africa, this virus is associated with immune deficiency only very infrequently. And when the immune deficiency occurs, it is usually not like the AIDS virus, not as severe. In fact, we know that the leukemia viruses can sometimes cause immune deficiency. In the proper genetics of the host, if a person has certain genetic characteristics of HLA class 2, the leukemia virus replicates abnormally, excessively, and in that circumstance can also give rise to an immune deficiency, but that's rare. Let us not lose sight that the epidemic of AIDS is caused by one virus in which there are many minor and sometimes major variations of this virus. This virus has been looked for in the United States and essentially nothing. It has been looked for in Italy and England, and originally positive reports were reported in the newspapers. But it turns out when reevaluating it, those were abnormal blood tests, but the virus that was isolated turns out to be HIV-1. So the amount of HIV-2, we still don't know, but clearly it is not so far at all significantly spreading or significantly contributing to what we call AIDS. That's the AIDS virus in the bottom left. Okay, as these two viruses are related to each other 50%, these two viruses are related to each other about 50%. Okay, so it's easy to remember. And the bottom viruses are related to these viruses only about 2%. Okay? Next slide summarizes the diseases caused by all human retroviruses. HTLV-1 causes acute T-cell leukemia of the T4 lymphocyte, almost always T4, greater than 90%. The disease is associated with the expression of receptors for interleukin-2. Also called the TAC antigen. It's a very aggressive, fatal disease, death usually occurring in 6 months from the time the disease appears. HTLV-1 also causes neurologic disease. I'll come back to that in a moment. It also can influence or increase the incidence of B-cell lymphomas, but by an indirect mechanism. T-cell leukemia is by a direct mechanism. HTLV-1 commonly is associated with minor immune deficiency. Rarely, it can cause a serious immune deficiency. HTLV-2 has been defined mostly in hairy cell leukemias of a T-cell type, but also in diseases known as chronic lymphocytic leukemia, T-cell, usually T4 again, and chronic T4 cell lymphomas, but only in unusual cases. Much more work needs to be done on HTLV-2. The reason it hasn't been done is because of HIV and the spreading epidemic of AIDS. HIV, the AIDS virus, of course causes AIDS. It causes brain disease, dementia. It increases the incidence by indirect mechanisms of B-cell lymphomas and Kaposi sarcomas and certain other types of human cancer that are usually rare. Recently, and not yet published, a former postdoctoral that some of you know, Vittorio Manzari, has discovered a new human retrovirus which he described in my laboratory about 2 weeks ago. It's now in press in the journal Science. He now has enough convincing evidence that I think we can say that this is indeed a new human retrovirus. He calls it HTLV-5. It is associated with a subfraction of cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, sometimes called mycosis fungoides. The difference in this tumor and these is that it is less aggressive. It is also T4, but it is negative for TAC antigen, interleukin-2 receptor. Next slide, please. Continuing on now, the major target cell of all human retroviruses is this lymphocyte. In the case of the AIDS virus, the macrophage and the relatives of the macrophage, as you all know, is also a target. Particularly from work done in our laboratory by my co-workers, Susan Gartner, who was here recently, and Mika Popovic. The cells related to the macrophage, such as Langerhans cell, follicular dendritic cells, which have been detected by in situ immunological procedures independently here in Hamburg by Professor Rex and his co-workers, leads us to believe that with the AIDS virus, maybe the most important target are the relatives of the cells of the macrophage lineage. But in addition, remember that all the human retroviruses have this cell as a major target, and this cell is central to the immune system. It sends out signals to many other cells. And so the abnormality induced in this cell or the destruction of this cell will greatly lead to immune abnormalities. When we come to the AIDS virus, we have a very particular, difficult problem. It is the most complicated virus, I believe, that humans have ever faced. I have heard a well-known American vaccine expert say that this is the most goddamned complicated virus I ever heard of. His name is Morris Hilleman. He made many of the vaccines in the United States. The problem is that the AIDS virus not only attacks this cell, it destroys this cell. It also harms the macrophage. It also hides in the brain, where it causes brain damage and escapes further immune defense. In addition to that, I told you earlier that all the human retroviruses tend to be silent until the T cell is activated. So it escapes the immune system also that way. In addition, the AIDS virus in particular, its envelope is heavily covered with sugar molecules. The envelopes of retroviruses are glycosylated, I told you, in general. But the AIDS virus is even more glycosylated. In that, it tends to escape neutralizing antibodies, very likely. Recently, Danny Bolognesi at Duke University, working in some collaborations with our lab and with people in Boston, have discovered that the AIDS virus envelope has a decoy. It has a piece of its envelope that induces neutralizing antibodies, but it's antibodies that go after this site but are unable to completely block the virus replication. So we call it a decoy that the virus uses, a decoy epitope. Well, if that weren't enough, the AIDS virus, as you know, since 1984, when we first discovered this in our laboratory, changes its coat. So every time you find a new isolate, it's a little different in its coat. And therefore, a vaccine against one virus may not work against the second. A vaccine that works with 10 may not work against 500. So this is why we face an incredibly complicated problem. Now back for a moment to the leukemia. Next slide. I show the next slide for historical purposes. This is the first human being from which a retrovirus was ever isolated. I've shown it in here in Hamburg many times. So this is the man who had T-cell leukemia that gave rise to the virus that we isolated in 1978 and again in 79 from the same individual. He came from the United States, from the South. He had no interesting past history, family history, personal history. Of course, he is not the first human being to be infected. He's just the first time we found virus. He had a very aggressive T-cell leukemia. Well, once we isolated the virus, we set out to do epidemiologic studies by using antibodies against the virus proteins and determining who in the world was infected, by determining who in the world has antibodies in their serum as markers for the presence of the virus. The next slide was made in 1982 and summarizes our experience with the epidemiology of the leukemia virus. The leukemia virus is endemic in parts of Central Africa. It is endemic in northern South America, in the Caribbean islands, Central America, and in southeastern rural United States. It is also endemic in Alaskan Native Indians at a low rate. It is also endemic at a very low rate in some towns in Spain, in one particular region in Italy, in Apulia, in a small region in Apulia, near a city called Lecce, L-E-C-C-E. There are clusters of disease in Amsterdam and also in London, and these are from West Indian migrants to those cities where you get increased incidence of T-cell leukemia. The virus is endemic in Japan, especially in the southern islands of Kyushu and Shikoku and Okinawa, which would be over here somewhere. It's also endemic in the southern part of Honshu, the main island of Japan. People who are infected carry virus with them. The virus does not spread casually, only by blood, by sex, or by mother to their offspring, by usually milk. In Japan, the Japanese government is intervening in these islands, and they are preventing mothers from giving breast milk to babies. This should stop the spread of this virus in the southern islands of Japan, I would estimate, within the next 10 years, substantially. Next slide, please. Now, this shows how the leukemia virus causes leukemia. I don't know how well you can see the slide,
but it's a simple picture of the integrated viral sequences of HTLV-1, which are flanked on each ends by sequences that all retroviruses have, known as LTRs. These are regulatory sequences. They also are the sites of covalent attachment of the viral genes to cellular genes. This would be cell sequences here. Okay? One of the viral genes discovered in HTLV-1 was unique in retroviruses. Out of the human retrovirus now came new discoveries for basic virology. Leukemia viruses of animals have only three genes, one that makes the viral core protein, one that makes the reverse transcriptase, and one that makes the envelope. But the leukemia viruses, and now we also know the cow leukemia virus and the monkey leukemia virus, contain an extra gene known as TAT, which makes a protein, which when the T cell is activated, goes to the viral LTR and induces more virus to form. Unfortunately, this protein also interacts with cellular regulatory sequences that induce the expression of the T cell growth factor, interleukin-2. In addition, and not shown on the slide, it also induces the expression of the receptor for interleukin-2. So we end up with a para or autocrine situation induced by this leukemia virus, which is shown on the next slide. We see a T cell on the left containing the sequences of HTLV-1 integrated. We see the TAT protein made, and in addition to activating the virus, activates interleukin-2, interleukin-2 receptor, so you have the situation now where you have receptor and growth factor. And you have this autocrine phenomena or paracrine phenomena. We can't always tell the two apart. Now, in time, a second event occurs, genetic, in which we don't need the growth factor anymore, and we end up with a cell that maintains abnormal expression of the receptor for the growth factor, and it is the leukemic cell as such. Now, the leukemia virus, next slide, I told you also causes neurologic disease. It causes a disease that has been called tropical spastic paraparesis, now called HTLV-1-associated myelopathy, a disease of the spinal cord associated with demyelination. It resembles the chronic progressive form of multiple sclerosis. Clinically, there is spasticity of the lower extremities, constipation, bladder incontinence, and in a man, sexual impotence. This is a serious disease, maybe more important than the leukemia. We do not understand the mechanism of this disease at all, except you can find the virus in the cerebrospinal fluid, and the people who develop this disease have a certain HLA class 2 pattern immunologically. And it seems that they cannot control replication of the virus. So in the people who develop the neurologic disease, there's much more virus, much more antibody to the virus. But the mechanism is open for somebody who is in the earlier part of their career than I am, such as okay. Now, I'd like to say to you that something about antiviral treatment. Would you use antiviral treatment in the leukemia caused by HTLV-1? No, it's too late. But you might use antiviral treatment for the neurologic disease because it may depend upon continued replication of the virus. We agree? And for AIDS, the pathogenesis of the disease depends upon the continued presence of the virus. Without the virus, there is no AIDS. And the virus replication is required. So AIDS develops because the virus gets to the brain. AIDS develops because the T cells are destroyed, directly and indirectly, by the virus. We can't go into all the mechanisms, there's not time. But because of that, we need to think about antiviral therapy. To think about antiviral therapy rationally, we must know something of the life cycle of a retrovirus. As far as we know, the life cycle of any retrovirus is about the same and is shown on the next slide. The first step in the life cycle is that the virus, and this is the virus, this is supposed to be the envelope here, the core. The first step is an interaction of the viral envelope at the cell membrane. With the AIDS virus, we know that the receptor, ironically, is the very molecule that gives the name T4. the CD4 molecule on a T4 helper lymphocyte is the receptor for the AIDS virus. We know more about that than we know about any other retrovirus receptor. Also strange. In any case, the first step is penetration of the cell membrane after binding by interaction of the viral envelope with the CD4 molecule. The second major step is the viral RNA is converted to DNA, catalyzed by reverse transcriptase. Then this single-stranded DNA usually circularizes and then integrates into the host cell DNA. And then if the viral genes are expressed, viral RNA is made, processed, viral proteins are made, genomic RNA and proteins are packaged at the cell membrane and released to complete the virus life cycle. If you like things simple, you can look at the virus life cycle like you look at the synapse of the neurologic system. You have an incoming phase, a stop phase, and an outcoming phase. How to interfere with this? Number one, we can try to block entry. The way this is being done today, at least being studied intensively in the United States and also in one group in London, is to use the T4 molecule itself. So you take purified T4 from the envelope, from the membrane of a T4 human lymphocyte. And in the soluble form, the purified T4 is used to bind the virus so that the virus can't find its way to the cell membrane. Now, this could lead to immunological side effects. We don't know yet. But these studies are ongoing intensively and, in fact, are going into clinical trials very, very soon. So, does everybody understand that? You use the T4 to compete, to bind the viral envelope before the virus gets into the cell. Okay? The second step that is being used for inhibitors is to block reverse transcriptase. Here, the major chemical under study has been AZT. Now, AZT is the only so far proven effective agent in AIDS. It doesn't mean it's a cure, of course, but it has been a major advance because it shows something can be done. When you think about it, how many viral diseases do you know you can do anything about with chemicals? Almost none. But within a short time, we have evidence that one chemical already is working, AZT, but it has side effects. And you need to use the drug lifelong, so it's far from perfect. We need other things. We need them fast. We need things to add to AZT that work by different mechanisms. Now, how does AZT work? It works at the level of reverse transcriptase by what we call a chain terminator. I like to think of this or explain it by comparing its mechanism to a string of pearls that a woman may wear. If you think of the string of pearls as DNA, and each pearl as the nucleotide building blocks of DNA, all pearls have a hook at the top and a hook at the bottom. The hook at the top attaches to the growing chain. The hook at the bottom allows another pearl to grab on. AZT is a building block of DNA that is abnormal. It's an analog. It doesn't have the hook at the bottom. So the next nucleotide cannot attach. So you have chain termination. Of course, it's going to be toxic to cells in our body that are proliferating and making DNA like the bone marrow. But it seems that the virus likes to use it more than our enzymes. Therefore, there is a margin of effect without toxicity for a while. We need more agents like it, as I said. Now, the other major area of research is here, the level of expression of the viral genes, and to control the formation of viral proteins and viral RNA. And to do this properly requires understanding something about the viral genome. And the viral genomes of all human retroviruses are shown in the next slide. Much credit for this work goes to my coworker, Flossie Wongstall, and many postdoctoral and senior fellows who came to our laboratory over the last several years that I can't mention. Suffice it to say, we were very lucky, particularly, I honestly say this, with postdoctoral fellows who came from Europe, who did the, quite frankly, much, the bulk of the work in 1983, 84, and 85 in our lab that led to our, whatever advances we have in the AIDS virus molecular biology. Now, the next slide, please. The viral genes that we must understand are summarized on this slide. First, you look at the top, there's the leukemia virus. I told you, you have this extra gene here. There's the three genes all retroviruses contain. Look at the AIDS virus. It's extremely complicated we found at least 5 more genes. There's, instead of just GAG, POL, ENV, here's TAT, like this one, only functionally different, and even its sequences are different. Another gene here, ORF, another gene here we call SOR, another gene here, R, another gene here called TRIS, which another group calls ART, A-R-T. We now have evidence that there are even more. So that the AIDS virus has at least 5 extra genes, and we think more. Those extra genes, most, if not all, are involved in fine regulation of the expression of the AIDS virus. We don't know why this virus regulates itself so carefully. This gene may be a repressor. We know that this gene and this are absolutely essential for the replication of the virus. Therefore, these gene products, if we understand how they work, if we understand the protein structure, may become the most important chemical targets for the treatment of people who are infected in the future. If we understand how they work, if we understand the protein structure, may become the most important chemical targets for the treatment of people who are infected in the future. My belief is we should treat as early as possible, but this is a double-edged sword. It is up to the individual physician, because if you treat a person who's still healthy and you hurt him, you have a problem. On the other hand, we know this virus is progressive, and so we are thinking more and more to treat earlier and earlier is logical. But we need more, again, we need things more than AZT. Now I'd like to tell you two epidemiologic features about the AIDS virus, just two. One is about double infection, leukemia virus plus AIDS virus. With the experiment I'll show you, it illustrates several features. Number one, double infection occurs, leukemia virus and AIDS virus. Number two, you cannot generalize epidemiologically. What is true in 1987 is not true in 88 or 89. What is true in Hamburg is not true in Frankfurt. What is true in West Hamburg is not true in East Hamburg. This is true with all the human retroviruses, not just the AIDS virus. What's true here is not true over there. So you have to look very specifically. Let me give you an example of a drug addict study done in New Jersey by my collaborators Blattner and Stanley Weiss with our lab. New Jersey and Louisiana drug addicts, 1986, heroin drug addicts. Next slide. Just look at this data in New Jersey by race. This is HIV. This is the leukemia viruses. In New Jersey, the white population overall, 30% are infected with HIV, 7% with the leukemia virus, and about 2.7% are double infected. If you go to the black population, it's worse. 45% are infected with HIV, 23.6% are infected with leukemia virus, 11% are doubly infected. Now, if you thought this is the case all the time, it's not true. If you look in different cities in New Jersey, the statistics are extremely different from one city to another, even though the cities are next door. But to show you more dramatically how different you can be in the same country, look at New Orleans, Louisiana. In New Orleans, the white population is only 2.6% HIV positive among drug addicts, IV drug addicts. More are infected with the leukemia virus. Now look at the black. The black population of New Orleans, none are infected with the AIDS virus. 136 black IV drug addicts, 1986, none. But almost half, 49.3%, are infected with the leukemia virus. One other point that comes out of this study, we should be testing the blood banks for the leukemia virus, obviously, also. You here, especially in Europe, are hearing much about HIV-2. Nobody is infected with HIV-2, okay? This is a point. We have to think about the leukemia viruses as well in the blood testing. The only other epidemiologic point I wanted to mention is Africa, the next slide. And I show it only to make clear some different features of viruses in Africa. On the top right shows a map of Africa with the distribution of the viruses in monkeys. Forget this title. It's not accurate. It's all the monkey viruses, leukemia and AIDS, or AIDS-related. They are in sub-Saharan Western Africa. Not shown on the slide is where is the leukemia virus? Exactly the same place in Africa, sub-Saharan, following the distribution of these animals that are infected. HIV-2 is present here only. No one can explain that. But most of these people are, in fact, healthy. Okay? The real epidemic, the HIV-1 epidemic, seems to start in this region, near Lake Victoria. And then Africa seems to be getting infected like this, concentrically, worse and worse. Now much of Africa, of course, is infected like the rest of the world. No one can say where the virus exactly originated or when. I think human beings have been infected for a long, long time, but I think the amount of infection has been very limited and that people died with their disease rather than spreading it. But with the changes that I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, the virus began to spread very dramatically in the late 60s or early 70s, particularly when there were social changes in Central Africa that had migrations occurring from rural populations into cities. Okay, now I'd like to finish the talk with a brief discussion of the pathogenesis of the AIDS virus. How does it produce the disease it produces, briefly? And a mention of vaccine. Next slide. You know the modes of transmission are blood and sex, once again, in mother to child by in utero and probably by milk. The infected mother is an extremely important route of transmission of all human retroviruses. Are there other modes of transmission? Casual transmission has never been demonstrated. But we do have two people who have, and three hospital workers or more, who have had infected, two people who have worked in making mass amounts of virus. How did they transmit in those cases? We've proven it because the analysis of the virus is the one that was in the lab. Those were special cases, again. People either not trained right or doing something wrong. Working without gloves or tears in the gloves with skin that has dermatitis and exposure. We think, but we don't know, that this was an infection through the skin route in those rare cases. But before you think that people who work with the virus are real heroes, remember that hundreds and hundreds of people have worked with human retroviruses since 1978, 79, with the leukemia virus, never a lab infection, and with the AIDS virus, at least since 82, exposure of blood, at least since 83, mass production of virus, and nobody until recently, only two infections, and those, I think, were very special circumstances. This is not a virus transmitted by aerosol. It is not a virus that is transmitted by insects. Okay? Let's go on. The major target cells, next slide, we go quickly, are the macrophage and its relatives in the T4 cell. And it appears that of minor nucleotide sequence differences can determine major biologic differences in whether the virus goes here mostly or there mostly. When it infects T4 cells, next slide, the cell will die if the cell is immunologically stimulated. We will be able to finish in about, can we hold for five? No, we have to go. What's the answer? Can we hold 5 minutes or is it too late? It's okay. But I don't know about the other one. Okay? Thank you. Okay. Please, I'm almost done, but I want to go through a couple more points. This is a T4 cell that's been infected, and it's immune stimulated. And you see what we usually see is a tremendous release of a large amount of virus in one particular cap of the cell. And following that, the cell degenerates, and that's direct killing by the virus. We don't know the exact mechanism. But we also know that there are indirect mechanisms. Infected cells release proteins that inhibit T cell proliferation. And one very interesting new finding that comes from Bolognesi at Duke University, I think is interesting for you to know about. Actually, he trained here in Germany, in Tübingen, came from Italy to the United States, and then went back to Germany to work with Werner Schaefer in Tübingen at the Max Planck Institute. And he has found that a major way for T4 killing is like this. When the virus comes off the cell, the envelope of the virus falls off. And the envelope will bind to the T4 molecule of uninfected T cells. So you have an uninfected T4. It sees the envelope. binds. Antibodies are made in vivo, patients, against that complex. And then killer cells of some type, he hasn't defined them, will attack and destroy that cell. And that's probably a major way the T4 cells are destroyed in vivo following infection with this virus. Indirect. Does that understand? Okay, next slide, please. The last point in the pathogenesis of the virus I want to mention to you are the malignancies. Now, when we ask the question, how does HIV give rise to an increased incidence of cancer? There are two cancers, B-cell lymphomas and Kaposi sarcoma, that we are most concerned with. The B-cell lymphomas, the pathogenesis for most of them is like this. The evidence tells us that 60 to 70% of these tumors are Epstein-Barr virus, the herpes virus positive. Almost all of you are positive for EBV, but only rare cells are infected. Those rare cells are probably immortalized by the virus, but our cytotoxic T cells contain those EBV immortalized cells in us so that the numbers are very few and their proliferation very little. But with HIV infection, the T4 cells are knocked out. Secondarily, cytotoxic T cell function is diminished. As a consequence, the immortalized B lymphocytes, EBV infected, expand. If you combine that with a chronic antigenic stimulation, that will signal B cells to divide. B cells divide with the right antigen stimulation, right? Well, what's the right antigen? If you're infected with HIV, you have HIV proteins for the rest of your life. So we assume it's an HIV protein. So you have immortalized cells in vastly increased number, undergoing chronic stimulation to divide by HIV proteins. In a B cell, the DNA is dynamic. You know that, if you didn't, from a few weeks ago, the Nobel Prize to Tanigawa, the reshuffling of the genes for immunoglobulin. All of this increases the risk for a translocation of the proto-oncogene called the MYC gene that you, I'm sure, have all heard about. This is the pathogenesis of Burkitt lymphoma in Africa. All you have to do is substitute malaria with HIV. Malaria in Africa, holoendemic, gives rise to chronic antigenic stimulation. Malaria in Africa, the Plasmodium vivax alters the function of cytotoxic T cells by diminishing T4 function. So the pathogenesis looks the same. But this is 60 or 70% of the tumors. We look for other things in the remaining 30%. And we discovered a new herpes virus 2 years ago, which is shown in the next slide. This new herpes virus, next slide, is shown here, and it's not related to any other human herpes virus closely. Next slide. We call it human B lymphotropic virus or human herpes virus 6. It infects B lymphocytes, but it also can infect some T cells, some megakaryocytes, and some cells of the brain. How important is this new herpes virus? We don't know. We're trying to do now a worldwide epidemiologic study. But we have found the sequences of this virus in 4 human B-cell lymphomas. But it does not give us a satisfactory answer to the B-cell lymphomas of AIDS, the remaining 30 to 40%. They are not usually HBLV positive in the tumor. So remember that viruses can cause a tumor directly, like HTLV1 with T-cell leukemia, in which the virus infects the cell, puts its genes in the cell, and that cell becomes a tumor. Virus can also be involved in causing a tumor by many indirect mechanisms, increasing the incidence of a tumor whose incidence would otherwise be very low. So in the case of the B-cell lymphoma, HIV is not directly causing the tumor, but it sets up an environment that the increased incidence goes way up. This herpes virus may be involved in an additional small percentage of those lymphomas. The rest we cannot explain. Finally, the Kaposi sarcoma. Next slide. Kaposi sarcoma is extremely interesting. There are 4 types. It is interesting, first of all, because there are 4 types. One, that is classical Kaposi that occurs in older Mediterranean men. The clinical course is chronic. It is not terribly aggressive. Then there is the somewhat related Kaposi that occurs endemically in Africa. Causes unknown. It's more aggressive than classical Kaposi. Then there is Kaposi associated with the doctor's treatment of people to get transplants, so they make them immune suppressed and they develop a Kaposi. Then there is the Kaposi's associated with AIDS. In fact, you don't need AIDS. All you need is HIV. This is a very aggressive Kaposi, and it occurs with much visceral involvement. This is shown on the next slide. You see first the skin involvement in an infected man with HIV. Next slide, you see the bowel wall completely covered by this malignant, by this tumor. Now, what is the nature of this tumor? We examined the DNA of the Kaposi tumor, and we did not find the sequences of any known virus. We look for HIV, it's negative. We look for other tumor viruses, it's negative. So we don't know the direct cause of the tumor. But there is a major epidemiological lead shown on the next slide. And that comes from studies by the CDC. In which case, if you look at both circles, these are people infected with HIV, but on the left are homosexuals. On the right are non-homosexuals. The Kaposi sarcoma is in the green plus red. And there's much more Kaposi in the homosexual than the non-homosexual. Why? Either there is another virus yet to be discovered, or it is something peculiar about the route of transmission of HIV. We don't know which of these is right. But I tell you again, the Kaposi tumor is negative for HIV. Well, I have to summarize an important story within less than a minute. Last 2 years, my coworker Zaki Salahuddin and a Japanese postdoctoral, Suji Nakamura, discovered how to grow Kaposi tumor cells regularly. They found a growth factor released in HTLV2 transformed cell media. So it may be a new growth factor. When we add it to human Kaposi tumor, the cells grow tremendously. And then they make their own growth factors, para or autocrine again. And they are making a tremendous concentration of interleukin-1, endothelial cell growth factor, fibroblast growth factor, and many of these factors make new blood vessels grow. And so we have a tremendous explosion of growth factors by these tumors grown in our lab. Now, next slide quickly, we're down to the last couple. When we put, let's forget this, we think that this slide just tells us that the Kaposi lesion in man may be explained entirely by these growth factors and cytokines. New blood vessels, chemotactic factors, fibroblast growth factors, endothelial cell growth factors. Remember that the Kaposi is also interesting because it is composed of different types of cells. Endothelial cells, new blood vessels, fibroblasts, spindle-shaped cells. So there's a lot of strange things about it. And the most interesting of all is that it is multicentric. Human cancer originates when a single cell becomes eventually malignant, and then it grows from the single cell. The Kaposi arises in multiple places at about the same time. Therefore, this may be a good example in vivo for a completely growth factor dependent tumor. And this picture is of a mouse, nude mouse, in which we took the human cells and that were grown in our lab from a Kaposi patient. And when the cells were fixed and put here, nothing happened. When the cells were put live, they made a Kaposi tumor in this mouse. If you examine that tumor, it looks just like human Kaposi, but if you do the chromosome tests, they are mouse. So the human Kaposi sarcoma, grown in our lab with a growth factor, makes its own growth factors, and then you take those cells and you put them in a nude mouse, and they rapidly make a mouse Kaposi sarcoma of mouse cell origin. Next slide. We now finish with a second of vaccine. The conclusion of the Kaposi work, before you look at this slide, is that we don't think it's a true malignancy in its early stages, but a growth factor dependent tumor, and therefore therapy early on should be directed not to kill the tumor with poisons, but maybe to interfere with the loop of growth factors and their receptors. Now, the final point I want to tell you about is a quick summary of where we are with vaccine. To make a vaccine, we need a source material. You would say, what about the killed virus, like Jonas Salk did with polio and others? That's ridiculous here, because the killed virus has nucleic acid. The nucleic acid can integrate and may cause an epidemic of some other disease. So we cannot use the whole virus, killed or modified. Therefore, we use a subunit. What subunit? Everyone is concentrating on the envelope. Maybe we should consider core proteins. That'll be next. What is our greatest dilemma? Shown in this slide is the approach to the vaccine. You take your immunogen, the candidate vaccine, and you put it in small animals, and you study neutralizing antibody and T-cell killing, T-cell response. If this is good, you then go to the only animal we know that can be routinely infected, the chimpanzee. And then you say, do you get this? And if you get this, then you challenge, you add virus, and you see if you protect the animal. Now, what's the problem? We have a major bottleneck here because the chimps are not available. They're present in very few number. They are on the endangered species list, and there's a great deal of trouble from the animal caretaking people, probably appropriate in part. We need more people quickly breeding chimps. We need more expertise in animal caretakers and so on. The only good news I can tell you is this. The virus has much variation. That's our second bottleneck. Even if we succeeded in a chimp with one virus, would we succeed against 100? The last slide is the only really good news I can tell you about vaccine. That's not good news. That's the second to last slide. That shows you that in one virus we can neutralize some, but then variants will emerge that are escape neutralization. That data is definitively established now in our lab in a collaborative study with Walter Reed. Okay, there's no question. You have within the person a mixed population of minor variants of the same virus. Those variants can escape with time, and then you lose whatever immune response you had. The last slide. This looks terrible for a last slide, doesn't it? The purpose, that's the real envelope. This was a collaborative study with people in Germany at the Pettenkofer Institute, directed by Fritz Steinhardt. The study was done by Hans Wolf and his colleagues at the Pettenkofer in collaboration with the people in our lab doing the molecular biology. When we obtained sequence data of a number of isolates, they put it into a computer, and they made this two-dimensional structural determination of the envelope. Here now you see the outer part, which on the first slide I showed you as a ball, green, remember, and a rod. That's the ball, that's the rod. What comes out of the sequence studies is that we have constant regions shown in blue. So despite all the variation, there are constant regions. And the other and final good news, that not only is there constant regions, but that the speed of the scientific progress, work in several labs, including our own, has led to the definition that this region is an epitope for neutralizing antibody, that this is a region with an epitope of T-cell immune response. This is also an epitope for T-cell immune response. This is the region where the virus binds, the envelope of the virus binds, etc. Now we believe this is the decoy. That's not the real neutralizing antibody site. The virus uses it as a decoy. Okay, the point of the good news is that the rate of progress in understanding the functional aspects of the envelope and the epitopes necessary for an immune response, and our hope has to be not trial and error, but in human intelligence to figure out how to put this information together, get more of it, and think how to get an effective vaccine. In my opinion, an effective vaccine is essential, not something just to dream about, but essential. I don't expect the virus to mutate out of existence, and I don't expect chemotherapy to ever completely contain it. And I don't expect public education will either. If a vaccine is obtained, then it'll have spin-offs to all of virology, I believe, and basic immunology. Thank you very much. Okay, okay. Thank you very much. Thank you. I appreciate it. I hope no one will yell fire.
I think, thank you. He stopped from Vienna to Hamburg to Florence, to Lieber, to Horst. Thank you.